it's Diane. Great to be back with you for our Tuesday podcast. On my mind, American diplomacy. For more than three decades, William J. Burns worked in the U.S. Foreign Service. He helped oversee policy in the Middle East under President George W. Bush, served as ambassador to Russia and deputy secretary of state under President Obama. Over the course of his career, he participated in the most consequential diplomatic episodes of our time, witnessing the power of negotiation and persuasion, a power he says the U.S. has largely abandoned. Now president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Burns reflects on his career in a new book, The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. Ambassador Burns, it's good to have you here.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks
for
having me.
Tell me when you began your career in the Foreign Service.
Well, I entered the Foreign Service at the beginning of 1982, so a long time ago, a much different era at the peak of the Cold War.
And you then begin your book with a moment you call American Diplomacy and Power at Their Peak. Talk about that moment.
Well, this was a moment just after the Cold War had ended when I worked for Secretary of State Baker in the George H.W. Bush administration. And it really was a moment where America's influence on the international landscape was at its peak. And it also intersected with a time when I thought the team of people charged with managing national security policy, led by President Bush, but also composed of Secretary Baker, Brent Scowcroft, the National Security Advisor, Colin Powell as the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, was a particularly impressive group of people. They disagreed with one another sometimes, but they were collegial, and they had a very practical sense of how best to apply that rare moment of American influence, and it showed in the achievements of that period.
So talk about that Madrid Peace Conference. Mm-hmm. In 1991.
Well, you'll remember that after Desert Storm, the hugely successful coalition that President Bush and Secretary Baker put together, Saddam Hussein was expelled from Kuwait. This created a moment, I think, of, you know, unsurpassed opportunity for the United States in the Middle East, a moment when people would pay attention to what we had to say or recommend. Secretary Baker understood that and decided that this was the moment to try to break the taboos which had plagued Arab-Israeli issues for a long time and bring all the Arab states, the Palestinians, the Israelis, and a variety of other international players into the same room at the same time, guided by the same set of negotiating principles. And it took him nine trips to the Middle East over, you know, the course of most of the year after Desert Storm. It reflected his persistence and his diplomatic skill. He still has a wall full of cartoons outside his office in Houston, most of which were poking fun at, you know, what many people saw to be a quixotic effort to put together a Middle East peace conference. But he persisted, and he brought all those players together, not so much because of the depth of their commitment to Arab-Israeli peace, but because of their respect for American influence and American diplomacy.
You know, it's so interesting. Everyone you mentioned, from President H.W. Bush, Secretary Baker, on down, they believed in the power of diplomacy.
They certainly did, and they were unsentimental about the reality that effective diplomacy has to be backed up by military and economic leverage and the power of our example. But they were able to employ diplomacy as our tool of first resort in a very effective way. Again, at a rare moment when America was the unrivaled power on the international landscape.
So why did you decide to begin your book with that incident?
I think it was a reminder, again, at a unique moment in America's history, where I really thought diplomacy was applied very effectively. A mix of both prudence and a concern about the second and third order consequences of what you might do. You'll remember the decision that President Bush made not to continue to pursue the Iraqis once they were expelled from Kuwait, when it was very tempting and certainly militarily quite straightforward to do. But he understood that doing that would have broken the coalition of countries who were united around expelling Saddam from Kuwait. And it also would have bought the problem, which his son later faced, of how to manage the day after in Iraq. And I thought, as Baker once put it shortly after that decision was made, that sometimes the smartest kinds of diplomacy are things that you don't do as opposed to things that you do. And so, again, I think not only that decision, but the whole diplomacy of the Bush 41 administration, which admittedly had its imperfections too.
Of course.
But it reflected a balance of both care and an ability to look around the corner at second and third order consequences, but also a willingness to be daring. German reunification, with a reunified Germany remaining in NATO, may seem in hindsight like a foreordained outcome. It was not at the time. And it took a fair amount of daring for Bush and Baker to see that opportunity and then to make it a reality, all in the span of a year after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
It was not only personal investment, but it was also financial investment in the belief that assisting those around us could help move the world in a more positive direction.
Absolutely. It reflected the sense of enlightened self-interest that I think animated the best of American foreign policy in the period after the Second World War. And it was certainly reflected in how George H.W. Bush and Secretary Baker viewed the world as well. And there's a big distinction, I think, between that sense of enlightened self-interest, how you invest politically and economically in widening the range of countries who share your interests, and the much narrower form of kind of muscular unilateralism that we see today from the United States, which I think, you know, runs the risk of squandering some of our biggest assets. And some of those assets really have to do with our unrivaled capacity to invest in alliances, to build coalitions of countries. That's what Bush 41 and Baker understood very well and applied. And I fear that that's not so well understood today. And it's going to come at a consequence.
And before we get to today, I want to go back to 9/11. Mm-hmm. Because you say in your book, we got it wrong. Tell me what you mean.
Well, I think, you know, certainly after the huge shock to our system, that the terrible attacks in New York and in Washington represented, we had to respond forcefully and militarily against al-Qaeda and the Taliban government in Afghanistan that was harboring them. There was no diplomatic way of solving that problem. But where I think we got it wrong was certainly in the run-up to the war in Iraq in 2003, when I think we let our instinct to hit back hard beyond Afghanistan overcome our better judgment. And we were so prone in that period, I think, to the sort of unilateral application of force that we didn't pay as much attention as we should have to the consequences of the day after in Iraq or to the opportunity costs. Because again, if you remember, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, and even after we and others working with, you know, Afghan oppositionists had overthrown the Taliban, there was a huge outpouring of international support.
Absolutely.
And sympathy. And had we not gone to war in Iraq, had we rather been more patient diplomatically, been very firm in terms of fighting terrorist groups and countries that continued to harbor them, but not been distracted and diverted by the illusion that Saddam Hussein was somehow connected to those al-Qaeda attacks, you know, we could have produced far better results than we did.
Ambassador Burns, I've asked this question of a number of people, including Colin Powell himself. I find myself going back and back and back and wondering what might have happened had Colin Powell said to President George W. Bush, I resign. I will not go to the UN and say that there are weapons of mass destruction when we are not entirely sure that those weapons are there. What would have happened if Colin Powell had said, Mr. President, I resign?
It's a very good question, and the honest answer is I don't know. I have enormous respect for Secretary Powell, as fine a leader as I ever worked for. The truth is that Secretary Powell, when he went before the UN, and many of us in the administration, really did believe the intelligence, however flawed it may have been in many respects, that Saddam was trying to conceal a continuing weapons of mass destruction program. That turned out to be false and wrong. So I don't know is the honest answer about what would have happened. You could ask the same question about whether Tony Blair, then the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, had, you know, had the same kind of blunt conversation. I think where we all failed, and I certainly include myself in this, is in not We tried to raise our misgivings, and I describe this in the book, about, you know, the questions we weren't addressing about the day after Saddam Hussein, the day after a conflict in Iraq. But we certainly didn't press that case as hard as we should have or as effectively as we should have. And, you know, for me, that remains, you know, my biggest professional regret in the 3.5 decades that I worked as an American diplomat.
What could you have done?
Well, I think certainly I faced the same question that you posed about Secretary Powell, either more forcefully making the argument that we were on a profoundly mistaken course, to more forcefully make the argument for containment of Saddam, recognizing that, you know, this was a deeply evil regime. No one need to convince us in the State Department about that. The question was whether or not, in terms of American interest, blood, and treasure, it was worth going, it required going to war over. I think the answer to that question is clearly no. And we could have made the argument, which we tried to make, but we could have made it more forcefully than we did. There were three, at least, of my colleagues in the State Department in that era who resigned from the Foreign Service over that same concern, just like the 24 or so career State Department people who had resigned in the early 90s over the Balkans. I have enormous respect for people who make that decision. Most of my colleagues and I chose to try to work within the system, to be honest about our reservations and our concerns and our criticisms, but ultimately to continue to serve. And
did you ever consider resigning?
Certainly there were moments when I did.
During that period.
And discussed that same subject with my colleagues, but in the end chose not to. I think any career officer has an obligation. Certainly, if you remain in public service, you have an obligation to be disciplined and not to run out in public and express your concerns. If they run totally counter to an administration's policy, your obligation then is either to resign, but it's also to be honest within the system, to be disciplined but very clear in your dissent. As I said, we tried to be, but we did not do it nearly as effectively as we could have or should have.
And the aftermath continues to this day, which I'm sure gives you a lot of regret.
It does. I mean, I would be the first to say that the dysfunctions of the Arab world, the fragilities of the Middle East, don't all stem from that profoundly mistaken to go to war with Iraq in 2003. But the war in Iraq in 2003 did accelerate and make worse a lot of those fragilities. And we're living with the consequences of them to this day. I mean, for all the focus on Iran's threatening actions, and I'm second to none in understanding the importance of pushing back against them, but the truth is that the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, coupled with the overthrow of the Taliban to the east, cleared the landscape for the expansion of Iranian influence in ways which I think that Iran Iranian regime never imagined before the war in Iraq.
Now, the other thing that's happened, it seems to me, is that the State Department itself has lost a great deal of the prestige, the esteem with which it had been held.
No, I think you raise a very profound point. In 3.5 decades as an American diplomat, I've never seen a moment when either diplomacy mattered more. We're no longer the only big kid on the geopolitical block. So our ability to work with allies, to manage new global rivals, to invest in coalitions matters more than ever. It makes diplomacy matter more than ever. But I've also never seen a moment over all those years when diplomacy is more dangerously adrift than it is now. Now, to be fair, I think some of that drift has deep roots. You know, through the end of the Cold War and immediately afterward, I think Americans became a little bit complacent about how important diplomacy was. We were the unsurpassed player in the world. So successive administrations between 1985 and 2000 cut the foreign affairs budget by almost 50%. After 9/11, as we discussed, I think we got into a very bad habit of inverting the roles of force and diplomacy. So diplomacy became a kind of, under-resourced afterthought. But I think the current administration, even against that backdrop, has taken those trends and made them infinitely worse. And
there is almost a sabotage of what the State Department was designed to do.
That's no exaggeration, unfortunately. You have a president who is, straightforward in his disdain for diplomacy, who sees diplomacy, I think, more as an exercise in narcissism than institutions. You have the pernicious practice of going after, in this administration, individual career officers, civil servants, as well as foreign service officers, just because they worked on controversial issues in the last administration. You have painfully slow progress in the State Department during the course of my career to expand its diversity, to make us look more like the country we represent abroad, both in gender and ethnic terms. That's been reversed. So for all those reasons, I think, again, as I said, at precisely the moment when diplomacy ought to matter more to American interests and values than ever, we're squandering, that opportunity and sabotaging one of the most important instruments that the American government has.
One of the issues that Donald Trump raised during the campaign was how much money the United States was spending on foreign aid. How much is it?
Less than 1% of the federal budget every year goes to the State Department budget and the foreign aid budget. And, that's something that's very poorly misunderstood in
exactly.
The United States. And to be fair, Diane, that's an element of self-criticism for all of us in government as well, because there has grown over recent years. President Trump has made it much worse. But what has grown is a disconnect, I think, between lots of American citizens and the Washington establishment, of which, in a sense, I guess I've been a card-carrying member for a long time. Most Americans, in my experience, don't need to be persuaded of the value of disciplined American leadership in the world. What they're less persuaded by is the capacity of the American government, through successive administrations, to be disciplined in how they match ends to means. But the truth, as you said, is that our investment in diplomacy and in development is a tiny fraction of the overall federal budget. Former Secretary of Defense Bob Gates used to like to remind audiences that there are more members of American military bands than there are foreign service officers. There's only about 8,500 foreign service officers serving the United States. I have nothing against American military music, but I think that reflects a little bit of an imbalance in our priorities, especially in this era.
And now a quick break. When we come back, more from Ambassador William J. Burns.
Thank you. DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Ambassador William J. Burns. His new book is titled The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. When you think about how our country's priorities have changed and the most recent summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, what would have gone into that meeting prior to the meeting had the normal operations of the Department of State been at work?
It's a very good question. I mean, the first thing I would say is I was never one to be critical of President Trump's interest in meeting at the highest level with the leader of North Korea. The truth is, none of us had exactly had a pristine record in dealing with the North Korea issue in years past. So it was worth trying something unusual. That helped explain the first meeting in Singapore last year. But in a normal world, what you would have done is recognize that diplomacy is hard work, to empower teams of American diplomats and specialists to take advantage of that first meeting, to engage in what is an extremely complicated and difficult process dealing with North Koreans, to try to hammer out practical steps to set up a potential second meeting. Because, you know, the currency of American presidents meeting with foreign leaders, especially pariah leaders like Kim Jong-un in North Korea, is pretty valuable. It adds to the stature of those leaders in ways that we should take into account. And so for that second meeting, you would have hoped that there would have been a much more exhaustive and systematic effort to prepare the ground. And that evidently didn't take place.
What would that have looked like?
Well, you'll remember, I mean, I led the secret talks with the Iranians over the nuclear issue throughout most of 2013. And the two situations are obviously not perfectly analogous. The most obvious difference is the Iranians didn't then and don't today have a nuclear weapon. What we were trying to do was to prevent them from developing a nuclear weapon and to sharply constrain their program and verify it in ways that ensured they wouldn't be able to cheat and break out. So that was a painstaking year of diplomacy that helped create the basis for an interim agreement, a first agreement with the Iranians, which froze and rolled back their program in return for very modest sanctions relief at the time. And we worked with a variety of international partners to help ensure that we could keep the pressure on the Iranians. And that in turn created the foundation for the comprehensive agreement that President Obama and Secretary Kerry and Wendy Sherman and others were able to conclude in 2015. Not a perfect agreement. I rarely see perfect on the diplomatic menu, but it was, in my strong view, the best of the available alternatives. And, you know, setting the irony aside, given the Trump administration's bitter criticism of Iran diplomacy, actually, the run-up to that interim agreement is exactly the kind of concept and approach that I would think you might be able to make work with the North Koreans today. Our long-term objective is to denuclearize North Korea. The truth is that's not going to happen anytime soon. What you could do, though, with that as a long-term aspiration, is an interim agreement which froze and rolled back their program, verified it, and made it less of a threat to us and to our allies in Asia.
And, of course, apparently Kim Jong-un said what he wanted was all of the sanctions lifted before any agreement could be reached.
Right.
Would there have been briefing books which would have informed President Trump that that is likely what would have come from Kim Jong-un.
Oh, I'm certain that that was the case. I mean, you had the heads of the U.S. intelligence agencies in public testimony before the Congress expressing their deep skepticism that Kim Jong-un was ever going to be prepared, whether in a meeting with President Trump or any other setting, to give up in one fell swoop his nuclear and missile program. So I have no way of knowing this for sure, but my strong assumption is that the U.S. intelligence community was doing its job and offering clear and unvarnished advice about what was possible and what was unrealistic.
So President Trump was relying on his own perception of the art of the deal.
That certainly appears to be the case. I'm the last person to argue that personal relationships and interactions between leaders don't matter. Of course they do, especially when dealing with authoritarians like Kim Jong-un. But it's not that simple. Diplomacy is hard work. It's not just narcissistic. It's about institutions and experts and people that you can bring to bear to try to narrow differences, to try to also build coalitions that are going to improve the leverage that you have. And that's another, I think, of the risks in the kind of triumphalism of President Trump's rhetoric and the singular focus on meeting at the highest level. Because what happens is you send a signal that things are not so urgent. And then the partners on whom we depend to keep the pressure on the North Koreans, whether it's China or others, take their foot off the pedal. And, you know, and then the North Korean leadership faces a situation where we've added to their stature through summit meetings, where we've contributed to a situation in which we're less able to apply the maximum pressure that the administration talks about, and where from Kim Jong-un's point of view, there's less incentive to make the kind of very hard choices that might make, you know, the sort of interim deal that I described possible.
You were ambassador to Russia from 2005 to 2008. What did you learn about Russia, and most especially about Vladimir Putin?
Well, Vladimir Putin, in my experience, I served as ambassador, just as you mentioned. I also served in our embassy in Moscow in the early 1990s. And Vladimir Putin, you know, is a very combustible combination of grievance and ambition and insecurity. Grievance in the sense that his conviction, and it's shared with lots of people in the Russian political elite, is that when Russia was flat on its back economically and politically after the end of the Cold War in the Yeltsin era, the Russia I experienced in the embassy in the early 1990s, that the West and in particular the United States took advantage of that. So when he became president now almost 20 years ago, you know, he was determined to restore the power of the Russian state and to restore Russia to what he saw to be its rightful place at the table of great powers. Now, he made some smart economic reforms early on. He also got lucky, in a sense, with oil and gas prices, you know, rising very quickly. And so he was able, quicker than many of us had imagined in the 90s, to put Russia back in a position where it could push back. And, you know, in many ways, I think Putin is an apostle of payback. And so he saw an opportunity to push back. Like many in the Russian political elite, he believes that great powers have an entitlement to a sphere of influence. And so, you know, he felt that Russia ought to have predominant influence over countries, sovereign countries like Ukraine and Georgia. And he was determined to push back. And so you had a situation where I think Putin became convinced that the way to preserve and expand space for Russia as a major power in the world was to chip away at an American-led order. It was also convenient for him because he could justify a very politically repressive system at home by pointing to enemies at the gate and insisting that the United States was determined not just to keep Russia down, but also to undermine the basis of his regime. So it's a very combustible combination of factors. But what it's created is a reality in which we have a pretty narrow range of possibilities in relations with Russia, from the sharply competitive to the nastily adversarial. And certainly Russia's interference in our elections in 2016 was a profound challenge. and has raised quite justifiable concerns about Russian behavior and Putin's behavior in particular.
What kind of relationship do you perceive or even infer between President Trump and President Putin?
I think what's obvious, at least, is that the president has a case of Putin envy or autocrat envy, in the sense that he's drawn to that style of leadership for reasons that escape me. Because I think history is not going to be especially kind to Vladimir Putin, in the sense that for all he's done to, you know, on the surface at least, restore Russia's ability to push back in the world, he's also not diversified the economy at a moment when he could have, when oil and gas prices were high. It's going to be very hard for Russia to compete in the 21st century without that. So part of this is the president's bad case of autocrat envy. I have no idea, and we'll all find out, I suppose, you know, from Mr. Mueller's investigation, what else lies beneath this, but it's very difficult to explain, especially when you have an administration that seems almost unanimously to push in a different direction with regard to Russia.
I also wonder about our relationship with our allies, Canada, France, Britain.
First, it takes a special kind of diplomacy to alienate the Canadians, you know, who have been our closest partner, some of our closest partners for many years. But I think what it reflects, and you hear this from President Trump consistently, is this sense that, you know, the order that we created, the alliances that we created over the course of the last seven decades, are somehow holding us hostage. You know, that we're kind of Gulliver being held down by all the Lilliputians who are allies. And I think that profoundly misreads this moment in history when, as I said before, the United States more than ever, even though I'm convinced we have a better hand to play than any of our rivals today, but we can rely more than ever on our allies and our capacity for coalition building, which sets us apart from lonelier powers like China and Russia. And on the 70th anniversary of the NATO alliance, for example, which is coming up later this spring, you know, I think that ought to be a moment of reckoning for us to realize, of course, we need to push our NATO partners harder to, you know, rebalance our share of, you know, defense responsibilities. That's not a unique insight for President Trump. His predecessors pushed on that, too. But we also have to recognize the significance of that alliance. Transatlantic ties today, actually, for all the focus on Asia, understandably, and China's rise, that actually makes transatlantic ties more, not less, important as we look ahead at that international landscape. So I think one of the biggest mistakes we're making today is squandering that opportunity to kind of sensibly rebalance those relationships with our closest allies, not just in Europe, but also in Asia as well.
And moving away from allies, what about the president's decision to walk away from any kind of agreement with Iran? Talk about that.
Well, I think it was a profound mistake for the United States to walk away from the Iranian nuclear agreement. As I said before, it's not a perfect agreement. It was aimed at limiting one source of danger and risk in the Middle East, an unconstrained Iranian nuclear program. But there remained the task of pushing back against Iranian behavior, which threatens us and threatens, you know, our friends in the Middle East. I just think there's a smart way and a dumb way to do that. The smart way would have been to build on the nuclear agreement and work with our friends in the region as well as the Europeans to push back against the Iranians. So what's happened now is after spending years and years isolating the Iranians, building political and economic pressure against them over the nuclear issue, we've now in effect isolated ourselves. And we've done, in a sense, Vladimir Putin's work for him in widening fissures between us and our closest European allies. And we've created a circumstance where I think the instinct of the Iranian regime right now is to try to hang in there with regard to the agreement. You know, international inspectors continue to report that they're living up to their side of the nuclear agreement. But there's the very real risk that there's going to come a point because they can't point to economic benefits or for other reasons that they pull out of the agreement. And then we're going to be back where we were before, facing the stark choices of either acquiescing in an unconstrained Iranian nuclear program or facing really difficult choices about using force. And there's also the danger of inadvertent collisions as well. You look across the Middle East now, whether it's Syria, the Gulf, Yemen, there are lots of places where we or our friends could bang into the Iranians, setting off a chain of escalation that would be really hard to manage. And the last thing the Middle East needs right now is yet another source of fragility, yet another military conflict.
What do you see happening in the Middle East with now Prime Minister Netanyahu under fire, under legal challenge, and the way we are dealing with Iran? I mean, those two countries are connected.
No, certainly there's the danger of an escalation of tensions there. Who knows what's going to happen in the Israeli elections? My track record at predicting in elections, either in this country and other countries, is not very good. But I just hope that whatever the outcome, people are going to wake up a little bit, not just with regard to Iran, because there again, I don't need to be persuaded that Iran's actions can be threatening, whether it's to Israel or to our partners in the Sunni Arab world. But I do think it was a huge mistake to pull out of the nuclear agreement. And similarly, I think it's important to refocus attention on, you know, what seems to be the very elusive and perhaps disappearing goal of a two-state solution for Israelis and Palestinians.
And finally, it does seem through all of this and everything you've talked about, that the United States is losing credibility around the world. What do you see as the impact of that?
I certainly do agree. I think the impact is that much greater because this is occurring at a moment of pretty profound transition on the international landscape anyway. In other words, no matter who got elected in 2016, they were going to have to come to grips with the reality of China's rise, of Russia's resurgence, of challenges to regional order, and of the big issues that go beyond the capacity of any one state, whether it's climate, as existential a threat as the world faces, or the revolution in technology and the need for some workable international rules of the road to maximize the benefits, but also minimize the dislocations. So at precisely the moment when disciplined American leadership would matter most, you know, we're sending incredibly erratic and uncertain signals. We're causing our allies to hedge and lose faith. Adversaries are taking advantage, and the international institutions that we work so hard to build and defend are starting to teeter as well. So I think that loss of credibility, that loss of confidence in the United States, especially on the part of our closest allies, is doing real corrosive damage right now. And my fear is that, you know, we're digging a hole for ourselves right now in the world, I'm afraid. We'll stop digging at some point. My fear, though, is we're going to climb back up to the surface out of that hole and look out on a surface which has hardened against our interests and our values in a lot of ways because we weren't there exercising disciplined leadership at a moment when so many things were changing on the landscape.
Ambassador Burns, you've written a very important book. I'm glad you were here. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Diane. It's really been a pleasure.
And that's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at wamu.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Yurev-Lipker. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you on Friday. I'm Diane Rehm.